This is the Radio Reader. I'm Bob Page, reading for Dick Estelle. As many of you may know, Dick has had serious health issues. After more than 50 years of presenting books to the public radio audience, he's made the incredibly difficult decision to retire. Unfortunately, Dick is unable to conclude the reading of John Grisham's Rogue Lawyer. I will be completing the final chapters in his behalf. For information on how to contact Dick and send your best wishes, visit the Radio Reader website at radioreader.net. Now to today's reading of John Grisham's Rogue Lawyer, published by Doubleday of New York. When we finished last time, the jury was being selected in the case of Tadeo Zapata. We'll pick up from there. To prevent further contamination, Judge Fabino decides to take each of the 22 and quiz them individually. We return to her chambers and gather around the same table. Juror number 3 is brought in. Her name is Liza Parnell, and she sells tickets for a regional airline. Married, 2 kids, age 34, husband sells cement. Mancini and I are all charm as we attempt to curry favor with this potential juror. Her Honor takes charge and starts questioning. Neither Liza nor her husband is an MMA fan. In fact, she calls the sport disgusting. But she remembers the riot. It was all over the news, and she saw the video of Tadeo pounding away. She and her husband discussed the incident. They even prayed at church for the recovery of Sean King and were saddened by his death. She would have a difficult time keeping an open mind. The more she is quizzed, the more she realizes how firmly she believes Tadeo is guilty. He killed him, she says. Mancini asks a few of the same questions. I take my turn, but do not waste time. Liza will get the boot soon enough. For now, though, she is instructed to return to her seat on row 1 and not say a word. Juror number 11 is the mother of 2 teenage boys, both of whom love cage fighting and have spent hours discussing Tadeo and Sean King. She hasn't watched the video, though her boys begged her to. She does, however, know all about the case and admits to having plenty of preconceived notions. Mancini and I politely poke and prod, but get nothing. She, too, will be excused. The afternoon grinds on as we work through the 22 jurors, all of whom, it turns out, know far more than they should. A couple claim they can set aside their initial opinions and decide the case with open minds. I doubt this, but then I am the defense lawyer. Late in the day, after we've finished with the 22, I renew my motion for a change of venue. Armed with fresh and irrefutable evidence, I argue that we've just seen clear proof that too many people in this city know far too much about the case. Go Slow listens and acts as though she believes me, which I think she does. I'll overrule your motion for now, Mr. Rudd. Let's proceed and see what tomorrow brings. Chapter 9. After court, partner drives me to the warehouse where Harry and Harry conduct their operations. I meet with Harry Gross and we review Judith's latest petition. She'll prepare a response, one similar to the other 3 already on file, and I'll sign and file it tomorrow. Partner and I go to the basement where Cliff and his team are already at work. From the first 4 rows of the pool, numbers 1 through 40, 9 people were quizzed privately during the afternoon session. I expect all 9 to be excused for cause, or for good reason. Each side has 4 challenges, 4 automatic hooks that can be used for no reason whatsoever. That's a total of 8. There's no limit on the number who can be excused for cause. The trick, the skill, the art, is reading the jurors and trying to determine which to challenge. I get only 4 strikes, same as the prosecution, and 1 mistake can be fatal. Not only do I decide whom to keep and whom to strike, but I also play chess with Mancini. Whom will he get rid of? Certainly the Hispanics. I do not expect an acquittal, so I'm angling for a hung jury. I have to find the 1 or 2 jurors who might show some sympathy. For hours, over bad carry-out sushi and bottles of green tea, we dissect each potential juror. Chapter 10. There are no phone calls in the middle of the night, nothing from Art Swanger nor Nate Spurio, not a word from Moss Corgan. Evidently, my brilliant offer of a deal didn't get very far. As the sun rises, I'm at my computer responding to emails. I decide to send one to Judith. It reads, "Why can't you stop the war? You've lost so many battles and you'll lose this one. The only thing you'll prove is how ridiculously stubborn you are. Think about Starcher, not yourself." The response will be predictably harsh and well-crafted. Partner drops me off in a strip mall out in the suburbs. The only store open is a bagel shop where smoking is illegally permitted. The owner's an old Greek who's dying of lung cancer. His nephew has rank at City Hall, and health inspectors don't bother the place. It features strong coffee, real yogurt, decent bagels, and a layer of rich blue cigarette smoke that's a throwback to the days not long ago when it was common to eat in a restaurant while inhaling the fumes and vapors of those close by. Nowadays, it's still hard to believe we tolerated that. Nate Spurio goes through 2 packs a day and loves this place. I take a deep breath out front, fill my lungs with clear air, walk inside, and see Nate at a table, coffee and newspaper in front of him, a fresh Salem screwed into the corner of his mouth. He waves at a chair and puts the paper away. "You want coffee?" he asks. "No, thanks. I've had enough." "How are things going?" "You mean life in general or the Zapata trial?" He grunts, tries to smile. "Since when do we talk about life in general?" "Good point. Nothing from Mancini. If he's in on the deal, he damn sure doesn't act like it. Still offering 15 years. They're working on him, but as you know, he's a jerk who's going places. Right now he's on stage, and that means a lot to him." "So Roy Kemp is hammering away?" "Yeah, you could say that. He's tightening every screw he can find. He's desperate, can't say I blame him. And he hates you because he thinks you're withholding information." "Gee, I'm sorry. Tell him I hate him too because he kidnapped my kid, but nothing personal. If he'll get to the mayor, who can then get to Mancini, we might have us a deal." "It's in the works, okay? Things are moving." "Well, things need to move faster. We're picking a jury, and based on what I've seen and heard so far, my guy is in deep trouble." "That's what I hear." "Thanks. We'll probably start calling witnesses tomorrow, and there aren't many of them. This could be over by Friday. We need to cut the deal quickly. 5 years, county penal farm, early parole. Got it, Nate? Does everybody up the food chain understand the terms of the deal?" "Plain as day. It's not that complicated." "Well, then tell them to make it happen. My guy is about to get slammed by this jury." He pulls on the cigarette, fills his lungs, and asks, "Are you around tonight?" "You think I'm leaving town?" "We should probably talk." "Sure, but now I gotta run. I have this trial today, and we're out here beating the bushes looking for some jurors to bribe." I didn't hear a word, and I'm certainly not surprised. "See you, Nate." "A real pleasure. And you really should stop smoking. Just take care of yourself, okay? You got your own problems." Chapter 11. Go Slow is late for court, which, on one hand, is not that unusual because she is a judge, and the party doesn't start until she arrives. On the other hand, though, this is a high water mark for her career, and you'd think she would arrive early and savor the moment. But I learned a long time ago not to waste time analyzing why judges do the things they do. Everyone has been waiting for at least an hour with no word on what's causing the delay, when her courtroom deputy snaps to attention and calls us to order. Her Honor sweeps onto the bench as if she's already terribly burdened and tells everybody to sit down. No apology, no explanation. She launches into some introductory remarks, not a single word of which is even remotely original, and when she runs out of gas, she says, "Mr. Mancini, you may examine the panel for the state." Max is quickly on his feet, strutting along the mahogany railing that separates us from the spectators. With 92 jurors on one side, and at least that many reporters and spectators on the other, the courtroom is again packed. They're even leaning against the rear wall. Max rarely has had such an audience. He begins with a dreadful, sappy monologue about how honored he feels to just be in the courtroom representing the good people of our city. He feels a burden. He feels an honor. He feels an obligation. He feels a lot of things, and within a few minutes, I notice some of the jurors start to frown and look at him as if to say, "Is this guy serious?" After he's talked about himself for too long, I slowly stand, look at her honor, and say, "Judge, can we please get on with this?" She says, "Mr. Mancini, do you have some questions for the pool?" He replies, "Of course, Your Honor. I didn't realize we were in such a hurry." "Oh, there's no hurry, but I really don't want to waste time." This from a judge who was an hour late. Max begins with textbook questions about prior jury service and experiences with the criminal justice system and prejudice against the police and law enforcement. By and large, it's a waste of time because people rarely reveal their true feelings in such a setting. It does, however, give us plenty of time to study the jurors. Taddeo is taking pages of notes at my direction. I'm scribbling, too, but I'm primarily watching body language. Cliff and his associates are on the pews across the aisle, watching everything. By now, I feel as though I've known these people, especially the first 40, for years. Max wants to know if any of them have ever been sued. A standard question, but not a great one. This is, after all, a criminal matter, not a civil one. Out of the 92, about 15 admit to being sued at some point in their past. I'll bet there are at least another 15 who are not admitting it. This is, after all, America. What honest citizen has never been sued? Max seems thrilled with this response, as if he's really found fertile dirt to dig in. He asks if their experiences within the court system would in any way affect their ability to deliberate in this case. "Nah, Max, everybody loves to get sued, and we do so without the slightest resentment toward the system." But he flails away with follow-up questions that go nowhere. For nothing but spite, I stand and say, "Your Honor, could you remind Mr. Mancini that this is a criminal case, not a civil one?" "I know that," Max growls at me, and we exchange nasty looks. "I know what I'm doing." "Move along, Mr. Mancini," Her Honor says. "And please keep your seat, Mr. Rudd." Max fights his anger and lets it pass. Changing gears, he wades into a sensitive matter. "Has anyone in your immediate family ever been convicted of a violent crime?" He apologizes for intruding in such a private matter, but he has no choice. "Please forgive him." From the rear, juror number 81 slowly raises a hand. "Mrs. Emma Huffinghouse, white, age 56, a freight company dispatcher. Her 27-year-old son is serving 12 years for a drug-fueled home invasion." As soon as Max sees her hand, he throws up his and pleads, "I don't want the details, please. I know this is a very private matter and very hurtful. I'm sure. My question is this. Was your experience with the criminal justice system satisfactory or unsatisfactory?" "Seriously, Max, we're not filling out a survey for consumer satisfaction." Mrs. Huffinghouse stands slowly and says, "I think my son was treated fairly by the system." Max almost leaps over the bar to run and hug her. "Bless you, dear, bless you. What an endorsement for the forces of good. Too bad, Max, she's useless. We won't get close to number 81. Juror number 47 raises his hand. Stans says his brother spent time in jail for aggravated assault, and, unlike Mrs. Huffinghouse, he, Mark Wattberg, was not favorably impressed with the criminal process. But Max thanks him profusely anyway. Anybody else? No more hands. There are three others, and I suppose I know it, but Max doesn't. This confirms that my research is better than his. It also alerts me to the fact that these three are not altogether forthcoming. Max moves on as the morning drags. He steps into another delicate minefield, that of victimhood. Have any of you been the victim of a violent crime? You, your family members, close friends. Several hands go up, and Max does a nice job of eliciting information that's useful for a change. At noon, Her Honor, no doubt exhausted by 2 hours on the bench, and probably craving apple slices, announces a 90-minute break. Tadeo wants to stay in the courtroom for lunch. I make a pleasant request to his handler, who agrees, to our surprise. Partner hustles down the street to a deli and returns with sandwiches and chips. As we eat, we talk softly, keeping our voices low so the deputies and bailiffs cannot hear us. There is no one else in the courtroom. The gravity of the setting and surroundings has settled in, and Tadeo has lost some of his cockiness. He's absorbed the unforgiving stares from those who might be called upon to judge him. He no longer believes that they are his peers. Softly, he says, "I get the feeling they don't like me." Such a perceptive young man. Chapter 12. Max finishes up around 3 and hands off to me. By now I know more than enough about these people, and I'm ready for the selection. However, this is my first chance to speak directly to the pool, and it's an opportunity to lay the groundwork for what every lawyer hopes will become some level of trust. I watch their faces, and I know many of them found Max to be obsequious, even a bit goofy. I have an abundance of flaws and bad habits, but fawning is not part of my act. I don't thank them for being there. They were summoned. They have no choice. I don't pretend that we're doing something great and they're part of it. I don't brag on our judicial system. Instead, I talk in broad terms about the presumption of innocence. I urge them to ask themselves if they haven't already decided that my client is guilty of something, or else he wouldn't be here. Don't raise your hand, just nod along with me if you think he's guilty. It's human nature. It's the way our society and culture work these days. There's a crime, an arrest, we see the suspect on television, and we're relieved that the police have caught their man. Presto, just like that, crime solved, guilty party in custody. These days we never, never stop and say, "Wait, he's presumed to be innocent, and he's entitled to a fair trial." We rush to judgment. "Questions, Mr. Rudd?" Go Slow squawks into her microphone. I ignore her, point to Tadeo, and ask if they can truthfully say that, at this moment, they believe he's completely innocent. Of course, there is no response, because no prospective juror will ever say she's made up her mind already. I move on to the burden of proof and discuss it until Max has had enough. He stands, arms open wide in complete frustration, and says, "Your Honor, he's not quizzing the panel, he's giving a law school lecture." "Agreed. Either ask your questions or sit down, Mr. Rudd," Go Slow says rather rudely. "Thank you," I reply, like the smartass I really am. I look at the first three rows and say, "Tadeo doesn't have to testify, doesn't have to call any witnesses. Why? Because the burden of proving him guilty lies with the prosecution. Now, let's say he doesn't take the stand. Will that matter to you? Will you tend to think he's hiding something?" I use this all the time and rarely get a response. Today, though, juror number 17 wants to say something. Bobby Morris, age 36, white, a stonemason. He raises his hand and I nod at him. He says, "If I'm on the jury, then I think you should testify. I want to hear from the defendant." "Thank you, Mr. Morris," I reply warmly. "Anybody else?" With the ice broken, several others raise their hands, and I gently ask the follow-up questions. As I had hoped, it becomes a discussion, as more and more lose their inhibitions. I'm easy to talk to, a nice guy, a straight shooter with a sense of humor. When I'm finished, Her Honor informs us we will pick the jury before we go home, and gives us 15 minutes to look at our notes. Chapter 13. The email from Judith reads, "Starcher is still upset. You are such a pathetic father. See you in court." I'm tempted to fire something back, but why bother? Partner and I are driving away from the courthouse. It's dark, after 7 p.m., and it's been a hard day. We stop at a bar for a beer and a sandwich. 9 whites, 1 black, 1 Hispanic, 1 Vietnamese. With their names and faces so fresh, I have to talk about them. Partner, as always, listens dutifully with little comment. He's been in the courtroom for most of the past 2 days, and he likes the jury. I stop at 2 beers, though I really want several more. At 9 o'clock, partner drops me off at an Arby's, and I fiddle with a soft drink for 15 minutes, waiting on Nate. He finally arrives, orders some onion rings, apologizes for being tardy. "How's the trial going?" he asks. "Got a jury late this afternoon, opening statements in the morning, then Mancini starts calling witnesses. Should go pretty fast. We got a deal?" He shovels in a large, crusty ring and chews fiercely while looking around. The place is empty. He swallows hard, says, "Yep. Woody met with Mancini 2 hours ago and fired him. He replaced him with a flunky who was planning to move for a mistrial first thing in the morning. Mancini backed down and agreed to play along. He wants to meet with you and the judge at 8:30 tomorrow." "The judge?" "You got it. Seems Woody and Janet Fabineau have some mutual dealings. Friends, whatever. And Woody insisted on putting her in the loop. She's good to go. She'll take the plea, prove the bargain, sentence your boy to 5 years at the penal farm, recommend early release. Just like you said, Rudd." "Marvelous. And Lynx thugs?" "Well, that investigation is going nowhere. Forget about it." He sucks on his straw and selects another onion ring. "Now, Rudd, the fun part. The last time I saw Swanger, the meeting was arranged through a prepaid cell phone he left behind for me in a pharmacy. I still have the phone. It's right outside in my van. I haven't used it since, so I don't know if it'll work, but if I get Swanger on the phone, I'll try to set up a meeting. I'll have to give him some cash." "How much?" $50,000, unmarked. He's not stupid. $50,000? That's about a third of the reward money. I'm assuming he'll grab it because he's broke. Anything less might cause problems. Last year you guys cashed in forfeited assets to the tune of $4 million, all retained by the department, pursuant to our brilliant state law. The money's there, Nate, and Roy Kemp would spend anything for the chance to see his daughter again." Okay, I'll pass it along. That's all I can do." I leave him with his onion rings and hurry to the van. As partner drives away, I open the cheap phone and call the number. Nothing. An hour later, I call again, and again, nothing. Chapter 14. Aided by exhaustion, the two beers and a couple of whiskey sours, I fall asleep with the television on. I wake up in my recliner, still wearing a suit but no tie, socks but no shoes. My cell phone is ringing. Caller ID says unknown. It's 1:40 a.m. I take a chance and say hello. "You looking for me?" Swanger asks. "Yes, as a matter of fact," I say, collapsing the footrest and bolting to my feet. Things are foggy and my brain needs blood. "Where are you?" "Dumb question. Any more stupidity and I'm hanging up." "Look, Arch, there could be a deal in the works. That is, if you're telling the truth, which, frankly, no one involved believes you're capable of." "I didn't call to get insulted." "Of course not. You called me because you want money. I think I can broker a deal, act as a middleman, without a fee, of course. I'm not your lawyer, so I won't be sending you a bill." "Very funny. You're not my lawyer because you can't be trusted, Rudd." "Okay, next time you snatch a girl, hire somebody else. You want the money or not, Arch? I really don't care." There's a brief pause as he thinks about how much he needs cash. Finally, "How much?" $25,000 now to tell us where the girl is. If they find her, then $25,000 more." "That's only a third of the reward money. You taking the rest?" "Not a dime. As I said, I'm getting nothing, and that's the very reason I'm asking myself what the hell I'm doing in the middle of all this." Another pause as he contemplates a counteroffer. "I don't like the deal, Rudd. I'll never see the other 25. "And we'll never see the girl, I think, but don't say it. Look, Arch, you're getting $25,000 from the very people who would shoot you on sight. That's a lot more than you made last year with honest work." "I don't believe in honest work. Neither do you. That's why you're a lawyer." "Ha ha, you're clever. You want a deal, Swanger? If not, I'm butting out. I got more important things on my mind these days." $50,000, Rudd. Cash. $50,000, and I'll tell you and you alone where the girl is right now. If this is a setup, or if I smell a cop anywhere around, I'll bolt, make a call, and the girl will be gone for good. Understand? I got it. I'm not sure about the money, but all I can do is pass this along to my contact. Work fast, Rudd. My patience is running thin. Oh, you'll find the time if the money's on the table. Who are you kidding, Swanger? The line goes dead. So much for a good night's sleep. Chapter 15. 3 hours later, I stop at an all-night convenience store and buy a bottle of water. Outside, I'm approached by a cop in plain clothes who grunts, "You Rudd?" Since I am, he hands me a brown paper grocery bag with a cigar box inside. $50,000, he says, all in hundreds. That'll do, I say. What am I supposed to say? Thanks. I leave the city alone. During my last conversation with Swanger about an hour ago, he instructed me to ditch my thug and do the driving myself. He also told me to forget the fancy new van and drive something else. I explained that, at the moment, I had nothing else and didn't have time to run to get a rental. The van will have to do. I try not to dwell on the fact that this guy is watching me. He knew the moment partner and I began buzzing around in a U-Haul van. Now he knows I have new wheels. It's astonishing that he's in the city enough to know these things, yet still undiscovered by the police. I suspect he'll finally disappear when he gets the money, which will not be a bad thing. As instructed, I call him as I leave the city on the southern bypass of the interstate. His directions are precise. Go 16 miles south to exit 184. Take route 63, east of the town of Jobes. As I drive, I remind myself that I have this trial that's supposed to kick off in just a few hours, or is it? If Judge Fabinaugh is really in the loop, what does that mean for the rest of the day? I have no idea how much surveillance is tracking me right now, but I'm sure it is substantial. I didn't ask questions, didn't have time to, but I know Roy Kemp and his team have called in all the bloodhounds. There are two mics in my van and a tracking device inside the rear bumper. I've allowed them to listen to my cell phone, but just for the next few hours. I'll bet they already have people closing in on the town of Jobes. A helicopter or two in the air above me would not be a surprise. I'm not frightened. Swanger has no reason to harm me, but my nerves are jumping nonetheless. The money is unmarked and cannot be traced. The police don't care if they get it back. They just want the girl. They're also assuming Swanger is smart enough to spot anything fishy. Jobes is a small town of 3,000. When I pass a Shell station on the edge of town, I call Swanger, as instructed. He says, "Stay on the line, turn left just past the car wash." I turn left into a dark paved street with a few old houses on both sides. He says, "You swear you got $50,000, Rudd?" "I do." "Take a right and go over the railroad tracks." I do as I'm told, and he says, "Now turn right onto that first street. It has no name. Stop at the first stop sign and wait." And that concludes our reading for today. We've been reading John Grisham's Rogue Lawyer, published by Doubleday of New York. For those of you who wish to contact Dick Estelle and send your best wishes, visit the Radio Reader website at radioreader.net. Until next time, this is Bob Page for Dick Estelle's Radio Reader from Michigan State University.